Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM with me, Sean Delaney. Inside Education is a weekly window on the world of teaching and learning from an Irish perspective. You can download hundreds of podcasts of previous programmes by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on podcasts. This week I bring you the second part of my interview with Professor Barbara Schneider from Michigan State University. On last week's programme, I spoke to Professor Schneider about her work with collaborators such as Joseph Krawczyk and Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, who are known respectively for the research on optimal learning moments in science and on flow. Our conversation also covered the importance of relational trust in schools and how students from areas traditionally associated with disadvantage can be supported to advance to college. At the end of last week's programme, Professor Schneider discussed how optimal learning moments in science lessons could be identified. This week, I continued by asking her to outline the implications of her research for teachers generally and Irish science teachers in particular.
The first thing they should take is they should come to the World Education Research Association this summer in Tokyo. And if you're a team, because there are three of us that are going to give a workshop at WIRA, and we're going to basically help people develop their own designs to use their own interventions in their own classrooms. And they don't have to be this particular design, but they could be other kinds of designs, but how you innovate and do innovative work. I think for teachers right now that are in Ireland, I would really be speaking directly to the science teachers, because I haven't really thought about it so much for how I would think about it in the context of other subjects in high school, particularly because so many of them are text-driven. And even the ones that are civic responsibility, I think I would need some more thought about what and how and what that really means. It isn't just, you know, having a garden and helping the homeless. There's, you know, a lot more to these issues of taking responsibility for other people than yourself. So I think that the questions for the teacher out there is for science. So we're going to talk to Ireland just about the science teacher. So what are the kinds of things to do? Well, the first is that nearly every country right now is reassessing their science curriculum and developing new kinds of standards. And I would encourage Ireland to be like every other country that right now has been doing these kinds of things, and I believe Ireland has. And then the next thing is to think about how can you have curriculum that actually is knowing and doing. It's the doing that really makes all the difference. There has to be doing that's principally based. It can't just be, you know, let's build a rocket. That doesn't help anybody, you know, or learn the periodic table. Those are not things that really make a whole lot of sense.
Building a rocket would be doing.
No, but it's not just building the rocket. It's why are you building the rocket? What are you trying to show with building a rocket? What's that rocket supposed to do? And how are you going to know whether or not it worked or not? And what is it going to tell you that you didn't know before you started? So, yes, that's part of the process, but that's only one piece in the middle of the process. If it's got to be towards something that you're trying to achieve. So the doing is really very important, but the doing, you know, and it also has to be assessed. And we believe in formative assessment as well as summative assessment. We believe in really strong designs. So for the teacher, it's complex, and it involves collaboration. It involves a whole series of different things. And we have a book coming out from Yale University Press called Learning Science that will be out in fall or early winter 2020. I would encourage people to get this and to read it. We will have certain things that we will put online for teachers to actually use lessons if they want.
Are any of the lessons currently in the public domain or available online?
They're not currently. There will be some sketches in the Learning Science book. And as we move along and work out some of these agreements with different people about how much of what we'll be able to put in, you know, online, because there are certain restrictions at universities as well as other places require, given, you know, who's patent and who's actually in charge.
You've also studied the impact of students' alcohol consumption on their feelings of social integration at school. What can we learn from that work?
That's work that I did with Robert Krosno. I would say go talk to Rob, because this is, no, quite honestly, this is a study that he did, and I was a co-principal investigator on. I think it's really important to say that this would not be my expertise, but it certainly is Rob Krosno, and I would strongly encourage you to go to the University of Texas at Austin. He was the chair of sociology, and talk to him about this, because this is something he knows very well, and he has done wonderful studies of schools and has several books on that, and also on young children. So our careers mirror each other's in a lot of ways, but that's really his topic, not mine.
And what about the one about a book you wrote called The Ambitious Generation, Americans, Teenagers Motivated but Directionless? What was that about?
That is the book that came out of the work that I did with Shiksum High, and that was that longitudinal study that we looked at about how young people learn about their careers. And that's when we found out that there is such a huge difference in how young people find out about their lives and how they assess themselves and the kinds of resources that are available to them. The co-author on that was, as I said before, David Stevenson, and he worked in the U.S. Department of Education. He was a sociologist as well. And what we did in that book is we coined this concept, which we called aligned ambitions. And aligned ambitions is when young people have a kind of an idea about, oh, I think, you know, it'd be great to go into medicine. And, well, if I'm going into medicine, how much schooling do I think I need for that? And so when they could take those parameters and put them together, they were aligned. What we started to see, which some graduate students and postdocs have found now, because we're looking at a different era, is that if you were over-aligned, that means if you got too much education for what you expected. But what turns out, in fact, a student of mine right here at AERA this afternoon at 2:15 will tell you what happens when you're over-aligned and your earnings, that more and more young people are taking dual degrees and using being
over. What kind of degrees?
Dual degrees, you know, so I'm going to study the law, and I'm also going to study economics, so that basically you end up with 2 degrees, and so it gives you a head up in terms of what happens to you when you're competing for a job, because not only do you have a law degree, but you have something else, and so we start to see these over-aligned students really with higher earnings over time. But when David and I were doing the Ambitious Generation, we saw kids that were underlined, kids that basically thought they could become a doctor by starting off at a 2-year community college, which is a very unlikely path, which isn't to say that there's not somebody out there that did that. It's just very unlikely, you know, it's just the majority of people who want to do that, that's not a good path. That young people who are aligned also are very strategic about their lives, so they take the right courses, they talk to the right people. If they don't have the right skill set, then they go about getting it. But that this kind of alignment process is really fostered through the family and the school. And when I finished that book and I started thinking, and I went to Michigan State University from the University of Chicago, I thought to myself, we have to find a better way of getting these resources into the school. And that's exactly how I brought together my thoughts and started the CAP program, the College Ambition Program, which was to try and put into high schools the resources that families, tutors, communities in more well-off advantaged families had that students that were low-income didn't have. And the College Ambition Program was the first of its kind. It rapidly became something that a lot of other people started to think about, and whether they were, you know, giving help with financial aid or they were talking about, you know, taking kids on trips to colleges. We were started to do all of that, and our model was slightly different. They call it the Cadillac model. Other people have said too ambitious. Another one of Barbara's ambitious studies is because we were trying to encapsulate all of it, and all of it through what we called a psych coordinator who worked in the schools, worked with the teachers and the counselors to try and build a much stronger community that offered all kinds of resources to help students be more strategic in their choices.
And you make a distinction between educational outcomes and occupational outcomes.
Yes,
can you say a little bit about that?
Sure. So today, if you ask young people, what are you going to do? Everybody gives you the same answer. I'm going to go to college. So college has sort of become like, you know, what if you didn't finish high school like 30 years ago, everybody's going to college. So, but college comes in all different, you know, colors and waves, and there are all different kinds of pathways in college that young people can take. And the idea is to try and find not just education, oh, I want to go to college, but kind of what kind of major do you want? What kind of college do you want to go to? Do you really want a technical program? Do you want to go to a vocational school? What are you really thinking about? So that kind of, we've tried to sort through and be a little bit more specific in pressing young people. And also if they don't know, we, you know, I want to go to 4-year college and I want it to be like this. The occupational one, young people, very few young people actually really have an idea about the occupation that they want when they're 18 because they're very smart. They know that no job today is going to last like their parents' job their whole career. That's not going to happen. You're going to have multiple jobs and do multiple things and the job you have today may not even be around in 10 years from now. So we try and think about fields and different ways of, you know, I'm really interested in animation. I'm really good with computers, and I'm thinking that, you know, maybe there's something, you know, so we try and build that kind of an idea with young people and use that rather than a particular specific kind of job. However, certain people that grow up in families where, you know, they're mother is an accountant and their father is, actually it's usually the mom that's, you know, the physician and the dad that might be an accountant, but the physician's very specialized and then they know things about specialized programs. If you're highly educated and if you are in these very top level jobs, in engineering, in any of these fields that have now become so highly specialized, those kids have a little better sense. But if they're not a family unit that communicates with each other and talks through these kinds of things at home, they just say the same kind of thing. Oh, my dad he works at Google, he's an engineer.
And are there specific curriculum materials for this College Ambition Program to help people talk about the kinds of fields that they'd like to work in?
Right now, we had originally thought about it that we would think about maybe developing a test or looking, but one of the biggest problems about these curriculum materials right now is that work is so fluid, occupations are so fluid right this particular moment. And I think that one of the things that I really think is crazy that some people still do is they bring in these adults that are in these jobs and have been in these jobs for 20 years. I mean, if you're a 16-year-old or a 14-year-old and you're looking at somebody like that, I mean, there just is no way that their life is going to look anything like it at all. And I feel that if, you know, we really have to get a better understanding of how these fields are quickly changing and, you know, expose young people to them. Now, television, the media, the movies, they become very important in all of this. So, for example, when we were doing our work in the 90s, the X-Files were a big deal. So all these kids thought that they were going to be, like, they were going to look and they were going to go out into the field and they were going to, like, go to a murder scene and look for aliens. I mean, they never thought that you'd have to, like, go behind a microscope. I mean, it was all very, you know, but on the other hand, the kinds of things that have changed so dramatically in science and medicine and everywhere has really altered the field.
It's so interesting that you talk about the role of television, because I know my own brothers, both of my brothers are engineers, and they credit it with watching MacGyver back in the 1980s.
That's exact, and television and movies, I think, can be very instructive in this. I don't think we can't believe that social media is a bad thing for children. It's an informative part of their worlds. And rather than move away from it, we have to embrace it. Do we want kids on a screen 24/7? Absolutely not. Should we have, you know, movies that kind of talk about what tomorrow will look like? Yes. Well, think about me. In the 90s, we had watches when we did, you know, the Csikszentmihalyi's work. And then we said, oh, we're going to move to phones. And people said, what are you doing? You can't do that. And then there were all these problems with IRBs and universities and all these things that had to be worked out. And now it's 2019 and the kids carry their own phones to school. And there's some parents that insist that their children have their phones because they track where they are.
You have studied what high-achieving females do after school. What did you find in that research?
Well, we found a lot of things. High-achieving females in working family situations. Unfortunately, the issues of the glass ceiling, at least in the last decade, remain. And when women don't get promoted and don't get advanced, they very often retreat back to their family life in part-time work and do not sustain that kind of momentum that they start with. That's particularly true in some fields like law, even in some medical practices they choose.
And it's happening in that order.
Right.
That it's the glass ceiling and then they go back to the family rather than going to the family and then suffering the consequences professionally.
It happens both ways. It's not one way then another. It happens both ways. One of the problems that when we were studying that in early 2000 that we saw is that when women took advantage of the opportunity structures for families, you know, for having families in places that they said, oh, we give you time off for this and that, that it never really worked. That it just, they were off the mommy track. And there were a number of books that were written about falling off the mommy track. The high-performing females, it varied by field, and I think Claudia Golden's work is really very important here, and other people like that that have studied different high-performing females in different kinds of fields and what happens to them and what kinds of fields are going to open up in the future. And it is certainly the case that now, you know, there are many more women in engineering than ever before. And then there's the question about if the field becomes feminized, does it become less desirable? Because, is also still a question. I think that for me, the most important thing that has happened, and we have some really nice evidence on this, is that parents, if they have two daughters, and are really very good about supporting those daughters, both educationally and in terms of their ambition.
And that specific combination, so that's a better combination, say, for a female than having a boy and a girl?
Well, I mean, parents are always equalizers, and it's not the case that the boy is going to be neglected. It's just that the girl had been neglected, and now she's not being neglected. So I wouldn't exactly put it that way, but I would say that they now have a much better secured place in the family constellation in terms of resources than they've ever had before.
Okay. What is a typical working day like for you?
I'm a very light sleeper, and so I like to get up early, and I like to answer my emails early in the morning, because then I have a better handle on what's left for the rest of the day. I really enjoy meeting with my students. One of my students gave me the best compliment I think I've ever had. He said, when you workshop my manuscript, I can see, like, it's your manuscript for just that minute. You treat it as if you had written it, and they all know that I'll go through 6, 7, 8 different iterations of a manuscript before I feel that it's even ready for anybody to look at. And I think that most of my day, I have a certain portion of my day that if I don't write in that period of time in my day, and it can be in the morning and it can be in the afternoon, and I've learned that right now we're in the field, and when we're in the field, your days are much more hectic and chaotic than they would be normally. You have many more meetings because you have to stay on top of it. You know, we have teachers in elementary school, and we have teachers that are in high school, and they're doing these wonderful things in science. We have to stay on top of it. We have to stay on top of our researchers who are in the field, watching them, making sure the data are right, checking in with my data manager, making sure that everything is being kept, you know, in contact. It takes a lot. You can't. It's a very different kind of a job, but at the same time, I get up very early. I do my emails. The rest of my day is really very, very oriented toward those kinds of things. And I work pretty much in the evenings. And I will say this, that I'm also a bit of a dilettante, as is my husband, who's a lawyer. And we enjoy, you know, the symphony, the opera, blues, jazz, theater, ballet, and we spend a lot of time in those things. He's a runner. I'm just a walker.
And is there a minimum period of time each day that you want to write for? That, you know, you'll be disappointed if you don't write for a certain duration of time?
Yeah, absolutely. If I'm not writing, if I'm not taking at least like 2 hours out of every day, it's very... Someone one time said she didn't write today. She's really in a bad mood.
And you would achieve that most days.
Yes. My weekends I do it. I write much more because I can actually, my children are all grown, and I can just really lock myself up and sit there and just go over it and over it again.
What is school for, or what are schools for?
Today, what schools are for? Schools are very important, and I appreciate people that homeschool, and I understand their kids that have very different kinds of talents and issues that parents feel, you know, they take them on certain kinds of experiences that their parents have, and so I understand part of that. But to me, we live in a society of people. It's a way to learn about the world you're going to be a part of. You have to learn how to get along with all kinds of people, and that there are certain things that you miss by not having experiences in school and learning how to encapsulate what it is that makes you a literate person. And sometimes there are certain kinds of things that we forget to teach just in the family that are really critical that get learned in school.
Well,
just how to get along with other children, how to get along with other people, how to share in ways that are productive, how to value the opinions of other people, how to think about the world in a bigger place than, you know, just what you might learn through your own religious life or the community that you live in. So that kind of opening experience, I think, is so vitally important today. More so than ever before, because our world is getting so much smaller. And that butterfly that, you know, flaps its wings over in Africa is really going to have an impact on what goes on in the rest of the world. So we can't just not think about things in one place as isolated from everything else that's going on. So I'm very much a believer that the future of our planet is our ability to understand the people, not just in our own country, but in places all over the world.
Is there a teacher who had a significant impact on you?
I've had wonderful colleagues, and they all have. I mean, Tony Brike, Jim Coleman, and Mahalia Csikszentmihalyi have been academically the ones that have just absolutely stretched my mind in ways I never thought that they would. And I've had one high school teacher in English that I remember, he said, "You're an awfully smart girl to spend so much time worrying about the boys." So I think that I learned my lesson very quickly then.
Have you a favorite book or blog or writer about education?
I have lots, but right now I think that I must have read Foundations of Social Theory. I still pick it up when I want to think about how it was that Coleman was able to do that, and then I'll pick up Flow too. I keep them both in my home, and every once in a while I like to look at them and say to myself, well, that's what you're aiming for.
It's good to hear that even someone as accomplished as Barbara Schneider likes to keep reminders near her of what she's aiming for. She is the John A. Hanna University Distinguished Professor in the College of Education and the Department of Sociology at Michigan State University, and I spoke to her at the annual conference of the American Educational Research Association last month in Toronto. That brings this week's Inside Education to a close. You can listen to or download almost 400 previous episodes of Inside Education by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on podcasts. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, was published by Routledge and is available for purchase on online bookstores or to order from your local library. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.